then grimaced at the phrase. He was sweating plenty inside the heavily insulated suit. Funny, he thought. This far from the sun, you'd think it'd be freezing out here. But even the wan, distant sun was powerful enough to drench him with perspiration. The suit doesn't let heat out, he knew. Maybe I ought to build a radiator into the backpack for long excursions like this. He had ventured out the main airlock 4 hours ago to direct the robots in their task of removing this section of pitted old meteoroid bumper and replacing it with a new section, straight from the storage bay. The robots, about the size of a snare drum with four many-jointed dexterous arms, were programmed for simple, repetitive maintenance tasks. Something as complicated as removing the old bumper and replacing it with a new one required constant commands from a human being. Theo imagined himself to be some kind of wizard out of an old fantasy vid, commanding a squad of trolls or gnomes. He wondered if he could build voice synthesizers into the robots and have them say, "Yes, Master," to him. At last the job was done. The tiny new bumper was in place, and the robots had used their cutting lasers to slice up the pitted old one into sections small enough to feed into the ship's miniature smelter to be melted down into new raw material. Theo pictured himself leading an army of laser-armed robots against the type of murdering bastard who had attacked their ship. "Slice them to bloody ribbons," he told himself. "What did you say?" Angie asked. "Huh?" "Nothing." "You mumbled something." "Nothing important. I'm coming in now."
Victor lay in bed, wide awake, beside Chyna Madagascar, who was snoring softly. "I ought to feel guilty," he thought, "sleeping with this woman instead of my wife. But life takes strange twists. If I want to use this ship to search for Pauline and the kids, I've got to keep the captain happy." Despite himself, he grinned into the shadows of the darkened bedroom. "You've got to admit," he said to himself, "that if this is what it takes to keep her happy, well, it's better than being poked in the eye with a sharp stick." Chyna was an accomplished lover, he'd found. At first he'd been surprised at her demand, thinking that a woman who'd prefer to have children through cloning and avoid being tied to a man in marriage would probably not be all that interested in sex games. But he'd been wrong. Captain Madagascar was passionate in bed, demanding. He'd done his best to satisfy her, and apparently his best was good enough to please her. According to her calculations, they were nearly finished with the grisly task of picking up the dead bodies from the Chrysalis massacre. Soon, perhaps as soon as the next few days, Captain Madagascar could report to Big George Ambrose that the job was completed. Then what? Victor wanted this ship so he could go deeper into the belt and find his family, drifting aboard what's left of Syracuse. For that, he'd need not only Chyna's agreement, but Big George's as well. "They'll tell me my family is dead by now," Victor thought. "They'll say searching for them would be a waste of time and effort." He clenched his jaw in the darkness. "And I'll tell George that my family are victims of the Chrysalis massacre, too. We've got to find them, even if they're dead, like all the others." "But they won't be dead," he told himself. "They're alive. Pauline is keeping them alive. Syracuse is keeping them alive. I'll find them. If I have to steal this ship from Chyna, I'll find them." Then a new thought struck him. "What if they agree? What if Chyna takes me out searching for Syracuse, and we find them? What happens when Pauline and Chyna meet?"
"Theo?" He opened his eyes, surprised to realize that he'd fallen asleep on the sofa. His mother was bending over him. "I guess I nodded off," he said, feeling slightly sheepish. "You've been working very hard," said Pauline. "We all have." She sat on the sofa beside him. "Angie's gone to bed?" he asked. "Yes. She was tired, too." He nodded and pulled himself up into a sitting position. "She was really good today, monitoring my EVA. She sat there all suited up for nearly 5 hours, ready to go outside if I got into trouble." Pauline smiled faintly. "Angela's growing up." "I guess she is." "You are, too." "Think so?" "I know so." You've taken charge of the ship, Theo. 6 months ago, you were complaining that your father didn't trust you. He always did everything himself. He never gave me a chance to learn, to show him what I can do.
Yes, I know, Pauline said gently. I understand. But I trust you, Theo. I know that you've put us on the right course to get back to Ceres, and you'll keep this ship running until we get there.
Theo felt a warm glow inside, but he didn't know what to say, how he should respond to his mother's praise.
Now, don't you think you'd better get some sleep? Pauline suggested. Tomorrow's another day.
You're right. He swung his long legs off the sofa and got to his feet.
Good night, Theo, said Pauline.
Good night, Mom.
She's right, he thought, as he padded to his own cubicle.
Tomorrow's another day, with 1,534 more to go.
Book 2, 3 years later. Eternal process, moving on. From state to state my spirit walks, and these are but the shattered stalks, or ruined chrysalis of one.
Smelter Ship Hunter, Bridge. They made an unlikely pair. Although Elverda Apacheta was near the end of her long life, she was still a regally tall, slim woman with the carriage of an empress. Yet her once haughty eyes of sparkling jet now looked out at the world with a weariness that grew heavier each passing day. Her high-flaring cheekbones and imperious nose spoke of her Andean background. But her long, colorfully woven robe hung loosely on her emaciated body, and her dead-white hair was disheveled, chopped unevenly, as if she no longer cared who saw her. Her only companion on Hunter had already died once, or tried to. When he had been a mercenary soldier, he had pressed a mini-grenade to his chest and set it off. Now he was as much machine as man, a cyborg whose face was half metal, etched with swirling, hair-thin lines. He wore the threadbare remains of a military uniform, all insignias and signs of rank rudely ripped off its fabric. He called himself Dorn, and said he was a priest. He and Elverda Apacheta had been on this lonely, interminable, thankless mission for more than 2 years. She had once been a world's renowned sculptress, the woman who carved the Rememberer out of a 2-kilometer-long asteroid. The magnificent sculpture rode in a high orbit around Earth, a work of art that attracted tourists from the Earth, the moon, and the man-made habitats in space between the two. Now she and Dorn searched for the dead, out in the silent darkness of the asteroid belt, and fled from the mercenaries who had been hired to kill them. Hunter was a massive ship, much too large for just the two of them. It had originally been built to smelt asteroidal ores on the way from the belt inward to the Earth-Moon vicinity. But the advent of nanotechnology made such bulk smelters obsolete. Virus-sized nanomachines separated pure elements out of the asteroidal rocks. Hunter went on the market at a bargain price. Dorn had use for the smelter, so Elverda Apacheta had emptied her retirement accounts to buy the vessel. For all its size and mass, Hunter was capable of bursts of high acceleration when they needed to flee an intruding vessel. They had not seen another ship, though, in several months. "We're approaching the coordinates you plugged into the navigation computer," said Elverda into the ship's intercom microphone. She was sitting in the command chair on the ship's compact bridge. Dorn was somewhere in the bowels of Hunter's equipment bay. "I will come to the bridge," his deep, heavy voice replied. She always wondered what his voice had been like before his shattered body had been turned into a cybernetic organism. "No hurry," she said. "It will be an hour before we reach the exact spot."